Hello and welcome back. We are finished with our anatomy, physiology, biochemistry section. And now we're going to move into the more fun section. At least that's what I think. I like the biochemistry well, but what I really like about the biochemistry is that it lends itself to learning how we can go in and optimize function using food and food and nutrients and herbs. So we have three different sections to this. So we'll go through that. And then our last section will be on conditions and how to look at specific conditions that how they may present to you. And what are some specifics, herbs and nutrients that have been found to work really well in that regard. So let's look at food and hormone balance. Take what I'm saying as education, not medical advice, especially if you're thinking about this in application to your own self. And also, when you're working with clients, please make sure that you're looking at this as you're educating them and you're coaching them, but you're not diagnosing them and you're not treating them. And it's really important to use that terminology. I can't stress that enough. And at times it seems like you are diagnosing them. You're assessing them. You're evaluating them. Just don't use the word diagnosis. Once you assess where they're at, which is the most critical part at the beginning of any process with anyone, then you'll know how to apply and coach them on lifestyle and diet and nutrition things that they can do that will restore balance. So you're not diagnosing, you're assessing and you're evaluating, you're not treating, you're not curing, you're simply rebalancing. And I take exception to a lot of things that come out that call something the cure. Like there's a book out, The Hormone Cure. Well, it's a hormone balancing solution. But I hesitate to call something a cure because, in my opinion, a cure is something that you can apply as is. Just take this, apply it, and it'll work for everyone. And that's not really the case. We're not looking for cures. We're looking for balance. I want to make sure that you're always doing these disclaimers with people because people can get funny and they can say, well, you told me to do this and it damaged me, or you told me to do this and it messed up my medication. They're always making sure that you're aware and even get somebody to sign something that talks about this. But it's just a good idea not to be living in a state of paranoia, but just to make sure that there's a clear communication between you. There are certain things in the day-to-day diet that most people eat that disrupt hormones. And there's certain foods that we're going to encourage our clients to eat that actually support good hormone metabolism. So charred meat, like put it on the grill and burn it to a crisp, or even just create that, you know, smooth inside, but the outside is blackened. That's charred meat, which creates heterocyclic amines. And the heterocyclic amines promote estrogen receptor alpha. And heterocyclic amines have also been found to be more potent than cigarette smoke at generating tumor growth and cancer. So it's really important that you educate people. They think that they're buying an organic piece of lean meat and throwing it on the grill and then charring it and to find out that they've got carcinogens in them plus promoters of the estrogen that is proliferative that can also lead to cancer production. Processed high glycemic foods, we know the drill on that. Sugar, but also flour and grains in general, especially the gluten grains. They cause inflammation, they disrupt the gut flora, they disrupt digestion, they cause surges in insulin levels, the blood sugar levels, they cause damage to various parts of the body, and they affect the receptors. Chemical-laden foods. So a lot of the chemicals are indeed estrogen disruptors or hormone disruptors. You guys know what those are already. You know, all the additives, all the chemicals, all the preservatives, those are all things that are going to disrupt the hormones. And some of them are actually blatant, block the receptors. And excess alcohol. Personally, I think any alcohol is in excess, with the exception of maybe the little bit in some tinctures. Because if you have any significant amount of alcohol going in, you're going to disrupt your liver detox. You're going to slow down your liver detox. And it's so important that the liver detox be working well so that you can take the hydroxylated hormones that are meant for excretion, move them through methylation, and then excrete them. Otherwise, you get the buildup of those intermediates, which we've found are dangerous, proliferative, and can cause all kinds of problems. Hydrogenated and oxidized fats, and we know the drill on that too. Anytime you take a fat and you artificially hydrogenate it or you heat it to a temperature above 118 degrees, you're causing oxidation of the fats. Oxidized fats, damage tissue. They damage cell receptors. They can damage hormone receptors. They can damage liver function. They damage your various glands and the production of the various hormones that we need. So oxidized and hydrogenated fats, you know that right from the start. You're going to be educating people about how to avoid those. So what protects your hormones? I tell you what, the stuff that's the most effective is the brassica family. Cruciferous vegetables, also that. Sometimes people call them the broccoli family. The broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, kale, whole bunch of them. I have a list that's comprehensive for you in here. These are the protective vegetables. Again, like iodine, people have gotten brassica-phobia, cruciferophobia, whatever you want to call it. But people have gotten scared of brassicas because of some research that said, oh, they inhibit thyroid function. And there are some doctors out there who are actually telling people they shouldn't eat brassicas or they should only eat them a couple of times a week. I did extensive research on the thyroid inhibition of cruciferous vegetables. They do have the ability. They have some components in them. It can be goitrogenic. It can inhibit your thyroid in extremely large quantities. Granted, there are some people who are sensitive, and when they eat raw cruciferous vegetables in excess, and usually that means they're throwing kale or some sort of cruciferous in a smoothie every day, they tend to have an exacerbation of their thyroid symptoms. In that case, I tell those people to cut back on the amount they do raw and eat them more cooked. But there's no indication that there's anything but benefit from eating cruciferous vegetables unless you've got a specific genetic or biochemical abnormality where you're not processing, say, the sulfur real well. But I don't want to see anybody educating people to stay away from this family of vegetables. It is so protective. It is so protective of hormone metabolism. It keeps your estrogens in the safe realm. It keeps the ratios between hormones working properly, and they're protective against cancer. So these are the vegetables that you need to be encouraging people to eat on a regular basis, unless, of course, they have some reason not to, you know, say an oxalate sensitivity or a problem with sulfation. And in that case, those are usually temporary situations that you're working on to get them balanced so that they could go back and do it. In some cases, if people have really inflamed guts, you're not going to have them do the raw cruciferous vegetables or raw any vegetables for that matter. Sometimes lettuce is okay, but the harder vegetables are not. So in that case, you're lightly steaming them. And the greens too, the daikon greens are really great. So we have broccoli sprouts, 20 times more potent than any other food in terms of keeping those pathways in the proper direction. 20 times. It's huge. And the protective effects of broccoli sprouts on cancer are huge. And from what I understand, the seeds, if you don't sprout them, but you eat the seeds, you can get as much of a protective effect as well. So let's talk about how these little powerhouse vegetables do their thing. So brassica consumption is linked with a statistically significant increase in the 2:16 ratio. The 2:16 ratio, when it's higher, is more protective of breast cancer. The 16 is a proliferative estrogen that causes damage. When you add 500 grams a day of broccoli to the standard American diet, you significantly shift the 2:16 ratio. So that means 500 grams, what is that? That is 3 times 5 is 15 ounces of broccoli. It's not a tremendous amount, especially if you're steaming it or stir frying it. It's not a tremendous amount. It's more than the average person eats, of course, because usually people eat, you know, a little bitty piece that maybe weighs a couple of ounces. This was a study where they did 34 healthy postmenopausal women. They did a diet recall and estrogen urinary metabolites. And this was where they found this, adding 500 grams a day increased this. Okay, and that's in the Journal of Cancer Epidemiology biomarkers. And broccoli sprouts contain 20 times the concentration of sulforaphane compared to mature broccoli. So let's look at some of these chemical constituents and see why the brassicas are such powerhouses. First, of course, let's meet the brassicas. What are the brassicas? So you probably know these, but daikon was one that maybe some people don't realize. Bok choy, daikon, radish, different kinds of radishes, the black radishes, the red radishes, they're all in this family. Wasabi, which is that powdered stuff you get in Japanese restaurants, and they give it to you with the ginger, and you're supposed to mix it with soy sauce and eat it with the fish, with the sushi. I put it on seaweed salad. Wasabi, really potent brassica, arugula, broccoli sprouts, Brussels sprouts, cabbages, all kinds of cabbages, kale, cauliflower, kohlrabi. I'd never had kohlrabi before in my life, but then again, I'd never had broccoli until I was 19. So not a surprise that I'd never heard of kohlrabi. Most people haven't. Collard greens. I never realized collard greens until recently that collards were also in the brassica family because they have a slightly different taste. They don't really have that mustardy kind of taste and smell. But they're considered one of the brassicas. So is watercress, mizuna, which is a type of lettuce, mustard greens, rutabaga, and turnip. So those are all the brassicas. And you can encourage people to stir fry them, to steam them, to use them in soups and smoothies and stews and all sorts of ways to get them. And it's not that hard to get a lot. It may be difficult to get a lot of them in a raw state. I could probably get a pound or two into the blender and blend them up. But if you lightly steam them, you can eat tons of them. And you can lightly steam them and blend them and make sauces and soups and all sorts of things. Let's look at chemical constituents of brassicas and how they work. We have indole 3 carbonyl, which is also known as I3C. We have diindole methane, which is DIM. And then we have sulforaphane. Then we have glucosinolates, which the isothiocyanate is that goitrogen in large amounts. And when you don't have good gut flora, because when you have good gut flora, it gets converted into sulforaphane. So it seems to be related to poor gut flora and poor detoxification enzymes, especially the cytochrome P450s in the gut wall that are doing detoxification. When those aren't working properly, then the isothiocyanate can disrupt the thyroid function. And I think that's the reason why some people can handle it and other people can't. If you have somebody who can't handle raw cruciferous because they say it flares up their thyroid symptoms, that may be a clue for you to start looking at what they're doing in terms of detox and what their gut flora is looking like. These chemicals promote estrogen receptor beta. Remember, that's a safe one, the one that stops proliferation, that is puts the brakes on when it starts to proliferate out of control. The brassicas also promote the safe estrogen metabolites, the 2-series and the methylated forms. So remember, the only hydroxy metabolite of estrogen that's safe is the 2. The 16 and the 4 are carcinogenic. The methylated forms, however, are all safe. And of course, having appropriate methyl groups is helpful, and brassicas do have some extra methyl groups that other vegetables don't necessarily have. So let's look at some statistics. This is from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. As your plant food consumption goes up by 20%, cancer rates drop by 20%. This was back in 2008. When cruciferous veggie intake goes up by 20%, cancer rates drop by 40%. So it's not just the addition of plant foods, but the addition of the brassicas. So encourage people to find ways to use these. Raw brassicas, baking, steaming, stir frying. The only thing you don't want to do is boil because you boil all the nutrients away. You cook them for too long. These chemicals that are helpful, the sulforaphanes and all, they tend to be somewhat sensitive to heating. Not as sensitive as some of the other water-soluble nutrients are. So you can maintain that with low-heat cooking for short periods of time. Best if you can get as many as you can raw, because then you also get all those other water-soluble vitamins without those breaking down. So let's talk about sulforaphane. It's a type of isothiocyanate derived from the hydrolysis of one called glucoraphanin in the cruciferous vegetables, and it's broken down by the intestinal flora. So the isothiocyanate, that's a goitrogen, will be broken down into sulforaphane if you have good gut flora. So telling people to go off of brassicas because they have a thyroid problem is, I think it's irresponsible. And I get that question all the time. So it's being popularized that we shouldn't be eating brassicas because of thyroid problems. And I don't believe that it's true. The evidence that I looked at, even with the raw, was not consistent. They took a group where they gave them the equivalent of like 3 boxes of broccoli sprouts every day for 20 days. And broccoli sprouts have the highest concentration. Nothing happened to their TSHs. Nothing happened to their thyroid function. They took a group of rats and they fed them isolated isothiocyanate. And actually, in very high quantities, nothing happened until they got to very high quantities, which would be the equivalent of 10 or 20 pounds a day in a human. And then there was a thyroid inhibitory effect, which was negated when they added iodine. So what I always tell people is, if you're going to do smoothies with kale and other cruciferous vegetables in it, go ahead and add some kelp or other kind of seaweed to it, because the iodine will help protect you from the goitrogenic effect. So sulforaphanes have been found to be anti-cancer, anti-diabetic, antimicrobial, and hormone protective. Why would you not want to be eating these things? It's certainly better than chemo, no? It's certainly better than insulin, yeah? It's certainly better than being on antibiotics. And certainly better than even being on hormone replacement therapy. Less expensive anyway. Broccoli is the highest amount of all the brassica family, and the broccoli sprouts and the broccoli seeds are higher still. They induce phase 2 detoxification. So in addition to this being helpful for your hormones, it's going to be helpful for everything. Your whole body is going to thank you. Your clients' bodies are going to thank you for telling them to do these things. So sulforaphanes, it induces cell and apoptosis. It induces it in the colon cancer cells. So it makes them pop. Explode. Done. Stop. Done. In addition, a side benefit is sulforaphane can inhibit H. pylori and protect the heart from inflammation. So why not? It's easy enough to do. Broccoli sprouts, broccoli, cabbage, all those great vegetables. Teach people how to make them taste really good, and they will be eating them on a regular basis. Incorporate them into green soups and smoothies and even salad dressings. I'll take a handful of broccoli sprout and blend it up with some tahini and other seasonings when I'm making a salad dressing. The more you can get in, the better. It synergizes with diindolmethane, DIM, to inhibit cancer growth. Now, you can buy DIM as a supplement, and some people may be so off and so out of balance that you want to get them back quickly and you have them buy it. But you don't really need to do it for the most part. You can get the protective effects of diindolmethane by eating more cruciferous vegetables. And I don't mean just eating a few pieces on a plate. I mean huge quantities of this stuff. Fill up your dinner plate with cruciferous vegetables. Make them taste great. It's really not hard to do. They've also found that it creates cell arrest, the apoptosis, the exploding of these cells in breast cancer cells. And this is from the Journal of Nutrition. So remember we talked, we want to increase the 2 metabolites, the 2 hydroxyestrones, and decrease the 16. So how do we do that? Well, cruciferous vegetables, we just talked about it. Indole-3-carbinol, DIM, I3C. They all do the same thing, and the sulforaphane. So these are the things you need to be doing. In addition, you can look at isoflavones, fermented soy and flaxseed. It's very important to distinguish between fermented organic soy versus commercially available soy that you might get at any Asian restaurant and most of the shake mixes that you'll find on the market. Isolated soy is not what we're looking at. The isoflavones are going to be concentrated certainly in the isolated products, but then you get the buildup of undesirables and they just don't work the same like fermented. And then flaxseed. And there's, again, controversy over flaxseed. Oh, it's estrogenic. But it promotes the good estrogen metabolites. See, we get this thing in our society that estrogen's bad. So anything that promotes estrogen is bad. And people are like, oh, don't eat flaxseeds anymore. Good idea to really do your homework. And see how people respond, too. Flaxseed can be very, very helpful. So let's look at DIM, diindolmethane.
DIM works in many, many ways to protect your body in addition to hormone balance.
Anti-angiogenesis. It protects your blood vessels. It keeps clots from forming in your blood vessels. It's anti-inflammatory, which protects your joints, your gut, your stomach, your brain.
Anti-inflammatory helps you with allergies, autoimmune diseases.
It promotes ER beta, estrogen receptor beta.
Remember, that's the protective one. That's the one that stops the over out of the growth, out of control growth of tumors. It's anti-androgen. Okay, so it promotes the estrogens. Now, if you've got somebody who is low in androgens, meaning the male hormones, then this may not be something you want to promote until you get them in balance.
It also is antiviral, antibacterial,
and by the nature of what it does, anti-cancer, because it's anti-proliferative.
And then the apoptosis, that's something, effect that it has on those cancer cells.
So let's just talk about the elephant in the room, the great soy debate. Some of you may be really big fans of soy. Some of you may have been reading about the dangers of soy. There's a lot of stuff being put out by Mercola, Weston Price. There's a book promoted by Sally Fallon. And this book, like, just nailing soy. I mean, soy is this awful stuff. But when you read the stuff more closely, like, I went to Mercola's site, and he's really an anti-soy guy. But when you read it, he's looking at the effects of GMO soy in processed soy. Tofu, isolated soy proteins, all kinds of those, the different shakes and various things that have the soy in it. That's not what we're talking about, that being protective. When you look at studies in people who are like eating a traditional Japanese diet and they're eating a lot of fermented soy, they have less death from estrogen-related cancers. In fact, there was a study in the Cancer Epidemiological Report that said that death from any cause was significantly reduced by 48% in the woman whose diet was highest in flavone-type foods. And it was even more striking in older women. It's not black or white. You're going to have to decide this. You're going to have to feel it out with each person and see what you think of for yourself. Look at the evidence. But really, the unfermented soy and the soy isolates can interfere with aromatase, and they can be thyroid inhibitors. I'm not saying I'm a big proponent of soy and everybody should be eating a lot of it, but I think that including some tempeh, miso, natto, or even traditionally fermented soy sauce without the wheat, of course, would be really helpful for a lot of people. Natto in particular has an enzyme called nattokinase, which is really great at breaking down blood clots and decreasing the viscosity of your blood. So it's really good for blood pressure problems and cardiac stuff. Miso, really been helpful for a lot of things related to gut bacteria. Okay, so there, all these things are fermented soy. Of course, it should be organic and non-GMO. But once you get into that, and really look at the evidence, read the book, and that the big anti-soy book. A lot of people quote that, but I think it's just, it's not good science. It's not good science. There may be some good stuff in there, but it's not providing both sides of it. It's a two-edged sword. And of course, we just want to stay away from completely the processed kind. Here's some other benefits of fermented soy. The miso and natto are rich in an isoflavoin called aglycones and in genistein and diazidine. And they're believed to be chemo preventatives. Natto has the highest fibrinolytic activity among 200 foods worldwide. Fibrinolytic means it breaks down fibrin, breaks down clots. Natto also contains K2 and isoflavon, which is another chemical that helps to prevent osteoporosis. Of course, K2, which works synergistically with D3 and breast cancer, and it slows down the aging process. So natto is the really traditional one. Most people in this country don't eat it because it's kind of stinky, and I think it's an acquired taste, and it's not readily available. Probably can find it if you go to Japanese markets. And if you're working with anybody Japanese, they probably know about it, and you can encourage them to look at it. And then the World Health Organization, Japanese who consumed large amount of natto and miso along with green tea, ginger, and ocean herbs have the longest lifespan of any people in the world. And that was taken from Mercola site. So he bashes soy on the outside, but then when you dig, he said, oh, but fermented soy is different. So I don't think we should be bashing a food because in certain forms, the processed forms, it's not good.
I don't think it's good science. Yeah.
The dark side of soy. Yeah. So nothing, it's not black and white. And I think we've idolized soy, especially people who are vegetarian tend to be, that's like the majority of what they're eating, you know? So you end up with somebody who's eating lots of wheat and lots of soy. Not a good match. In general, we just want to keep encouraging people huge quantities of vegetables. The vegetable is the main part of the meal. There's a little magnet I have on my refrigerator that I got when I ordered something from Joel Fuhrman's site. I think I ordered some DHA from his site. And it says, the salad is the main meal. The salad is the main meal. You know, and you throw the extras on that. So if you make a huge salad and you make up some cruciferous vegetables and you have a few pieces of natto or tempeh on there, it's not going to be a dangerous food. It can be very protective. I think anything in excess is going to be problematic. And I've been gun shy about a lot of the research because when you dig, like even on Mercola's site, everything he said, there was not a single thing that didn't say, well, GMO soy this and isolated soy that. But nothing said if you sit down and eat a big bowl of edamame, which is green, that's not fermented soy, but it's fresh out of the ground. I haven't seen any negative studies on that. And if anybody has, please bring it to my attention. I'm not here in defense of soy. I'm just here to prevent both sides of the equation. Personally, I don't eat it. Every now and then I've had a piece of, somebody asked me once, well, can you eat tempeh without cooking it? And I said, I don't know, you know, let me try it. So I bought some, I was going to make it for my son. And I took some and I just ate a few pieces of it. And it actually tasted quite good without cooking it. And then I cooked some up for my son and he didn't like it. So I ended up eating it, but it was quite pleasant and it's a good source of fermentation. It's a good source of good probiotics. So I'm, like I said, I'm not here to say soy, soy, soy. I don't do it myself personally, but I want to present a way to look at it because people that you work with, they're going to be looking at these foods and saying, well, that's what I eat mostly. Well, what am I going to eat instead? And if you could say, well, instead of tofu, let's switch you over to some tempeh, right? They could still do stir fries with it and they can do most of the same thing. So that's my spiel. A few more things on soy and some studies. These are things that you can go and research for yourself and see what you think. These were some soy studies that related to estrogen, that it promotes the 2-series, and death was significantly reduced in postmenopausal women eating more flavone and isoflavone foods. Another breast cancer, 18 studies published in the Journal of National Cancer Institute on soy and breast cancer concluded that soy is an overall protective effect against getting breast cancer. Now, maybe the isolated stuff is a problem. I don't know. But this study, British Journal of Cancer, is saying that for each 10 milligrams of soy isoflavones consumed daily, the risk of getting breast cancer is reduced by 16%. And again, we're going back to what is eaten in the typical Asian diet. They're not sitting around eating soy powder. They're not eating soy muffins and soy this and soy that. They're eating the traditional foods. They're eating it in the form of miso and tempeh and natto. 25 to 50 milligrams is more than most American diets contain, and it protects. So you can look at the studies, you can make your own decision, and you can decide how you're going to counsel people. And it may vary from person to person based on what their needs are, based on what their traditions are. But if you go into this thing and you read the soy, the dark side of soy, and you're going, soy is bad. And you have somebody who's a traditional Japanese and they come to see you and they're eating natto. And you're going to say just dogmatically, no, you got to get off the soy. Just look at it. If it's protecting them, why? If it's not and they have an allergy, that's different because soy is one of the allergens, especially in this country, because we started to feed our babies soy, right? Soy in a bottle. And that's like the worst possible. That's genetically modified. It's not organic. It's isolated. And that's where I think a lot of the allergies develop from is babies being exposed to these big molecules early on, causing damage to their gut, leaky gut, things get in. Or while their guts were still permeable because they were supposed to be drinking breast milk, instead they were drinking soy formula, which got into their system, and we have a lot of allergy to it. So assuming you're not allergic to it, and really work with people to find out, and you may want to do an elimination diet. I always recommend doing an elimination diet of the top allergens or putting them on a rare foods diet of foods they don't eat that often. Green salads are high in flavones. Tomatoes are high in flavones. Soy, tea, cherries, grapefruit, and healthy low-fat soups. And those are just generally soups with green vegetables. You want to avoid non-whole soy products like powders, pills, and isolated isoflavones. So this is talking about real stuff. And again, like I said, I'm not promoting soy. You have your own opinions of it, but I encourage you to really look at it in an unbiased way and see, and not just throw out everything about soy just because some of the soy products may be problematic. There's a lot of research on both sides of it. It's true for most things, though, right? You can find a study that will prove pretty much anything you want to prove. And if you don't find one, you can design one. So it's really looking at the research is one thing. I like epidemiological studies where you're looking at populations and comparing. That gives you more of a real life thing. But a lot of the contrived studies are set up so that they get the results that they want. So I'm a little bit leery of some of the biases there. My favorite, dairy. Women who consume dairy products have higher 16 estrogens. Dairy products have been associated with higher rates of ovarian and uterine cancers, as well as breast cancers. The cow estrogens are not human estrogens. They increase the risk of estrogen-related cancers. And people say, well, I eat only organic dairy. It still has hormones in it. Same thing with organic meat. It doesn't have additional hormones added to it, but you're eating the flesh or the secretions of an animal that has estrogen, and especially in the milk. There's estrogen there. Okay. So it's going to increase the risk of estrogen-related cancers. You can look at that study if you want to go through it. I personally am very anti-dairy. I'm not on the fence about it. I don't look at it and say, well, you know, raw dairy and whey and fermented and all this stuff. Some people do okay on goat milk dairy because the casein ratio to whey is a lot closer to human milk. Human milk is 20% casein, 80% whey. And that's a general statistic. And if you look at cow dairy, it's 80% casein and 20% whey. And whey tends to be the easier to digest and the easier on the system, but it's not without its own problems. In researching on insulin resistance, I came across a body of research showing that while whey does not raise glucose levels, it raises insulin levels. So you're still getting the insulinogenic effect, which is the negative effects of high insulin, the damaging effect on your blood vessels and on your artery walls and on your blood pressure and on inflammation and on and on. So it's not a good idea. So I'm anti-dairy. I really am. If I have somebody who's vegetarian, but they'll eat dairy, I would encourage them, if they really want to eat an animal protein, that they look more at eating something like fish that's been, you know, deep ocean, or really ethically raised beef or meat that hit, or wild game, something like that. Because I think it's less damaging than dairy. I just don't see it. It's just completely different. Goat dairy is a little closer to human in that it's 40% casein and 60% whey. But again, I'm not thrilled with the whey thing anyway. Dairy contains something called insulin-like growth factor. Insulin-like growth factor, IGF-1, increases tumor growth. Lots of studies that support that. The natural estrogens, we're so concerned about the xenoestrogens in the environment, right? Protect yourself from that. But the natural estrogens in eating like the dairy products and even eating in meat are going to be 100,000 times more potent than their environmental counterparts because those are slightly different. You got somebody who's like really adamant about only eating organic food and not eating out of plastics to protect from xenoestrogens. You got to be taking another look at dairy. A lot of the things in milk that are not desirable, it doesn't matter whether it's raw or processed. Fermented, if you're going to have somebody that insists on doing dairy, it should be from a non-cow, a sheep or a goat. It should be raw, organic, grazed on grass, not been fed in pens, no pesticides, no bovine growth hormone added to it, and then fermented. It's a lot of steps to go through. It's a lot of steps to go through. Then it reduces the risk. I did some research on this a few years back. I wrote a very long blog post. If you go to my blog and you just type in the word dairy, and I looked at, well, what about the raw dairy? And I looked at a lot of videos and a lot of research, and I concluded that no way. I can't recommend it. I can't recommend it. If somebody needs extra protein because of some specific issues, I'd rather them get it from flesh than from dairy. So, and I've been vegetarian, vegan for a long time. And that's still my feeling about it. And personally, too, if I was, you know, people have asked me, like, if you're at gunpoint and somebody says you either get to drink this milk or you get to eat this steak, I would take the steak. Well, if they're both organic. Anyway, I would eat the steak rather than the milk. I just feel that strongly about it. Here's more about dairy. Dairy accounts for 60 to 80% of the estrogens that people consume. Why? Because you drink it a lot. You eat the cheese, they drink the milk. They're probably getting more of that than they would be a piece of steak. The milk and cheese consumption, they're strongly correlated to testicular cancer among men 20 to 39. Increased rates of dairy consumption linked with rising death rates from prostate. So here we are, testicular and prostate cancer. Tell that to a guy. They're much less likely to want to lose their body parts than women are to lose their breasts. Not that I think either one is a good idea. Butter, meat, eggs, milk, and cheese are linked to increased rates of hormone-dependent cancers. Okay, across the board, here's a study. Breast cancer linked to consumption of milk and cheese. This was an article. I would encourage you to go to that article. It had a lot of good stuff, a lot of references. It was from a physician in Mongolia, and she was quoting a bunch of different studies that you may want to look at as far as the links between cancer and milk and cheese, because so many people don't want to give it up. They don't want to give it up, and they're going to fight you on it. It's kind of like the gluten issue. People are emotionally attached to it, and they don't want to give it up. Okay. A lot of people come, and they'll say to me, okay, I'm willing to go vegetarian, but I won't go off dairy, and I won't go off gluten. And they're surprised when I say, you know, I'd rather you go off of dairy and gluten than go vegetarian. And this is from a 28-year vegetarian. Lignans. Lignans are estrogen-like plant chemicals. They're in plants. They are highest in, believe it or not, sesame seeds and flax seeds. They're one of the major classes of phytoestrogens. So what are phytoestrogens, right? They're plant estrogens. We have some particular foods that have estrogen-like compounds. Well, we know already the isoflavones in soy, estrogen-like compounds. There's some in isoflavones in clover, red clover, and it's often used as a menopausal herbal treatment. Well, these lignans are estrogen-like plant proteins. Flax and sesame seeds, real easy to get, not hard. Grind them up, sprinkle them on salads. Very easy to get. They inhibit ER-positive breast cancer cell proliferation. They inhibit it. They're also found to a lesser extent in pumpkin seeds, soybeans, broccoli, beans, and some berries. So it's not hard to get extra lignans. Now, does that mean you're going to sit down and just have a plate of lignans all day long? No, it's a balanced diet. Lots of the vegetables, the cruciferous vegetables, mixed in with these lignans. If you don't want to go the isoflavones and you have an issue with soy, you can go with these. This is really a good way to go. And this was the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition back in 2010. 14% less likely to develop breast cancer postmenopausal women with the highest intakes of lignans than those with low intakes. Didn't apply as much to premenopausal women, by the way, if you look at the study. Isoflavones, estrogenic, anti-estrogenic. Okay, so they activate ER-beta receptors. They increase sex hormone binding globulin, which will help to reduce the amount of free hormone that's traveling around. That may be good, it may be bad. It just depends on where the person's at. So they can go both ways, and that's where making a decision about the particular case is helpful. They decrease the urinary excretion of the 16 and the 4 series. Is that good? Well, I don't know. It depends. If it decreases the production of the 16 and 4 series, and as a result decreases the excretion, then that's a good thing. But if it decreases the excretion because your body's holding on to it, that's not a good thing. So I think the jury's out on that one. These isoflavones are highest in soybeans and red clover, and these are often used as menopausal foods. They're found in kudzu, mung beans, alfalfa sprouts, black cohosh, and chickpeas. And when we look at some menopausal herbs, we'll look at more related to that. my buddy. I have gotten so many good results for getting people off of gluten. So many people find balance. Some don't, and there's a lot more digging we have to do. But when you have gluten in the system, it's inflammatory. Inflammation stresses your adrenals. Stressed adrenals eat up all the pregnenolone, the progesterone, and you don't make enough of your sex hormones. Okay? So getting the gluten out reduces the stress. The other problem with gluten is that the antibodies to gluten can cross-react with your thyroid, leading to autoimmune thyroid and inflammation of your thyroid. That's going to affect your sex hormones as well. The malabsorption caused by gluten in the gut leads to nutritional deficiencies. So you're not going to have as many of the nutrients you need, which means that you're going to have a whole out of balance, out of whack hormone profile. The effects on estrogen and progesterone are via adrenal exhaustion. There's effects on the gut flora, effects on neurotransmitters, and gluten problems tend to worsen at perimenopause. So if a person has a problem with gluten, but they really didn't realize it, they had a little PMS or, you know, they had a few problems here and there. When they get around menopause, they can go through a horrible menopause because suddenly that gluten intolerance gets worse. I had somebody on the phone the other night. She came to an adrenal call and she said that she was shocked at how bad her menopause was because she didn't have very bad periods. She was pretty okay before that. Probably gluten intolerant. It got worse. It was aggravated by the shifting of the hormones, the need to be able to detoxify more, and it caused her to go into really bad menopause. That's the food. We're still going to look at food, but we're going to look at it from a different perspective. We're going to go to macronutrients and then micronutrients. Macronutrient estrogen modulation. And we know that macronutrients are our big nutrients, right? They're the nutrients that we need in large amounts. So what I'm considering macronutrients here are fiber, protein, fat, and carbohydrate. And we're going to look at how those affect estrogen metabolism and hormone metabolism in general. There was a study done on the Journal of Steroid Biochemistry and Molecular Biology, 2008. 30 grams a day of fiber is what we need to keep our hormones safe. Now, the average American probably gets 5 grams of fiber a day, right? Pick up the average processed packaged food that most people eat, the TV dinners or the fiber bars or the snack bars or the drinks, and there's very little fiber. So if you're on the green smoothie regime, I mean, one of these green smoothies, add it up. So the next time you make a green smoothie, get one of those boxes if you can, the little plastic things. I know they're not the best way to do it, but they're pre-measured and pre-washed, but they also have the nutrient thing on it. It'll say how much fiber is in that one thing. Make a smoothie and calculate up how much fiber is in there. And then see what you get in terms of fiber. I think it's easy to get 30 grams of fiber a day on the kind of diet that we are recommending people. Lots of plant foods, lots of cruciferous vegetables, lots of really good, even our foods that are fatty. One cup of avocado has 10 grams of fiber. That's a third of what's being recommended. You have that avocado over a huge salad, and you have chia seeds for breakfast like we recommend. Amazing. Nuts even have good fiber. So I would say that it's not that hard to do. You just have to educate people. You'll have to sit down and show them, right? When you eat that candy bar, you get this much fiber. When you eat this bowl of chia seeds with cashew yogurt and whatever else you put on it, you get this much fiber, you see? And when you have this green smoothie and then you add some extra chia seeds to it, this is how much fiber you get. And help people to see this. Really sit down and help and calculate for them. The fiber binds the unconjugated estrogen in the large intestine, right? And the unconjugated estrogen is the kind that is hard to get rid of because the conjugation is what happens in phase two. So if you get unconjugated estrogen in the large intestine, rather than it being reabsorbed, it gets bound and it gets carried out. Otherwise, it gets reabsorbed in the intestine. It lowers the free estrogens. So that's the active available to bind to receptor sites. Okay. A high-fat, low-fiber diet promotes the four series. The four series, right? So if you're eating the McDonald's breakfast and the pizza for lunch and whatever else for dinner, high fat, low fiber, 4-series estrogens. What are they? The most potent. Protein. I couldn't find a whole lot about protein, like about too much protein, not enough protein. But what I did find was a study that said inadequate dietary protein might decrease overall cytochrome P450 activity, which makes sense because those are enzymes or proteins, right? Especially one called P450-1A2, which detoxifies estradiol. I did some searching. I did some preliminary searching. I probably should go to Medline to find some other studies, but I had a sense that, you know, protein's important, but not as important as everybody makes it out to be who are, you know, doing the, you need to have 300 grams of protein a day. Too much protein is not good for your kidneys. But protein's important. And that's why when we do detoxes or gut cleanses, I have people think about doing a protein powder to increase the level of the protein without increasing the complexities and the nitrogenous wastes too much. Fat, really critical for hormone balance, right? Fat forms the basis of the hormones, right? Cholesterol. But your body can make cholesterol if it has the right kinds of fat. So high saturated fat diet promotes 16-alpha, the proliferative one. So we don't want to eat a high saturated fat diet. There's a lot of hoopla out there right now. There's the paleo diet, which has a lot of really good qualities to it. I really like a lot of things about the paleo diet. They're taking everybody off of processed foods. They're taking them off of dairy products. They're taking them off of the soy and the grains and the gluten and all that. And they're eating lots of vegetables. But they promote a lot of saturated fat in the form of animal fat, in the form of like butter and lard and tallow and all this stuff, which is concentrated, isolated, saturated fat. And they poo-poo the studies that were done that show that saturated fat can contribute to heart disease as those being invalid because they weren't looking at saturated fat from organic meat. And there's a whole bunch of reasons. Now, I don't know which way each individual is going to go. Some people are going to need a higher saturated fat diet, some people lower. But the saturated fats need to be from clean sources. And I don't know what particular saturated fats were studied. Generally, they're animal fats that are studied in these things. Coconut is generally tends to be protective. Take it with a grain of salt. Omega-3 fats we know promote the 2-methoxyestrone, the protective one. So omega-3 balance is super, super important. And that omega-3, omega-6 balance is super important because when you have too much omega-3, six, it's inflammatory. So I'd encourage you to go back to the module that we did on fats and look at that and use the spreadsheet. And you're welcome to use that spreadsheet with your clients to help them figure out what their ratios are so that you can help them to be more omega-3 dominant. Estrogens and omega-3 oils work synergistically. Estrogen helps you absorb and maintain the omega-3s, and the omega-3s protect you against the bad estrogens and promote the methoxies. So they work hand in hand. Okay. So when you have the good omega-3s, you're going to make the better kind of estrogen, and that better kind of estrogen is going to help you to absorb your omega-3s better. So it's a win-win situation. Omega-3s also help reduce C-reactive protein. So then what are the sources of the omega-3s? Some say it has to be from fish, because the fish have readily available DHA and EPA. However, algae is a really good source. You just have to eat more of it. Algae also contains EPA and DHA. And now there are supplements on the market, which are algae oil supplements that you can take. So if you're opposed to fish or concerned about fish, not really sure about the safety or whatever, then the algae is a really good source. You can eat the algae if you're really good at it and you take a few tablespoons a day of blue-green algae. Chia seeds are a great source. So are hemp seeds and flax seeds and walnuts. However, they are forms of the short-chain omega-3s. You need to have really good intact nutrients. And we'll go into the nutrients here. And all these nutrients that we'll go into related to the estrogens and the hormones are also important for the conversion from the short-chain to the long-chain. You remember the delta-60 saturase enzyme we talked a lot about, and having good magnesium and B6 and pantothenic acid and B12 and boron and a host of other nutrients and zinc. You have to have those all intact. So when you're working with somebody who is not going to eat algae and is opposed to eating fish, some people just don't like the taste of anything fishy, then you really have to work at getting them to have sufficient quantities of those short-chain omega-3s and then sufficient cofactors. So extra B vitamins, extra things like zinc and turmeric and ginger, bioflavonoids. There's a lot of things that go into that. So review your omega-3 chart. And I keep that chart handy. When I was doing more face-to-face work with people, I had this little booklet that I kept. I put in the dividers and I put a lot of these charts, and I've shared a lot of these charts with you. The chart that shows the conversion of the steroid hormones. So you can just like at a glance say, okay, this is what happens when you get stressed. This gets high, these suffer. Is that what you want? You can show them really simplified chart, the omega-3 chart, the inflammation chart that I gave you, the hormone chart is another one. Any other charts that you think could be helpful, or make your own up and then put them in little sleeves so that when you're consulting with someone, you can show that to them. You can make copies of it to give them, to take home with them, and they can show their family members to show them why they're having a problem. I think education is really super important here.